Well,
he looks ready to me.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
All right. So I'm going to open the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness Committee. And we don't have any committee bills to introduce today. So good morning. We're just going to jump right in. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2476. And as I call forward Barry Pack from DAS, Wendy will read a summary of the bill.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2476 allows the Department of Administrative Services, with the approval of the governor, to adopt by rule uniform policies and procedures that affect multiple state agencies, commissions, and boards. The bill declares an emergency and would be effective upon passage.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Barry Pack, the state's Deputy Chief Operating Officer at the Department of Administrative Services. It's a pretty self-explanatory bill. When Ms. Simons asked me if I was going to bring a one-pager, I thought, well, this is a one-page bill. It'd be rather redundant. So I think best to explain the origin of the bill and a little history will give you a sense of what we're trying to do here. But we're actually trying to clarify the rulemaking authority of DAS to enact rules that govern the operations of government and that they apply to more agencies than just DAS. And I'll share with you the story about how this came up. So last spring, a federal judge ruled Oregon's constitutional ban on same-sex marriages to be unconstitutional. And with that ruling, then, same-sex marriage became legal in Oregon. There are all sorts of rights and responsibilities and obligations that go along with marriage, and agencies have been set up to apply those that are in law to married couples through various forms, processes, and procedures. Many of them are adopted by rule. Those did not accommodate legally married same-sex couples from other states. And so we knew that there was going to be a period of time where people were going to be getting married. They were going to want to apply for any of those rights or obligations or responsibilities. But agencies would not have had the time to be able to go through and adopt new rules or amend rules or forms or policies in order to accommodate that change. And so agencies came to DAS and asked if we could adopt a uniform rule that would cover all executive branch agencies so that on a temporary basis, so temporary rules only exist for 6 months, and then they are repealed, to give some cover, if you will, something for agencies to rely on while they went through the process of identifying what rules they would need to change in their own internal organizations. We asked DOJ for their opinion on that, and they said, yeah, we're pretty sure you can do it, but it's not really as clear in the statute as we might like. So we went ahead and did it. We issued a pretty simple rule that just said you recognize these marriages the same way you recognize any other legal marriage from another jurisdiction. Agencies were able to rely on that. They went through their own process to amend their rules. We had no complaints, no issues coming up out of that thing, but we felt like it was at least beneficial to come to you and suggest that we clarify in the rule in case some other situation comes up on a completely that the topic wasn't the issue. It was whether or not our rulemaking authority could govern other agencies in their operations. So not in their program, not in the outcomes they're trying to get to, not the what, but the how. So we had this bill drafted that goes along with the rest of the rulemaking authority that DAS has around its own set of programs that we operate, the internal service supports that we provide, and just clarifying that in those circumstances, we can adopt a rule on behalf of more than just one agency on an operational question. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions to start us off? Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's been over half the bills that are going to be submitted this session are going to have an emergency clause on them. And Article 4, I think it's Article 4 of the Oregon State Constitution, says that that emergency clause causes two things to take effect. One of them is that the bill takes effect immediately, and the other one is that the people don't have the right to do a referendum on it. So I had a bill that I gave the Legislative Council, and the topic of the bill doesn't really matter, but they wanted to put an emergency clause on there, and one of the reasons that they wanted to do that was so that the bill would go into effect right away, and that would give DAS the ability to write rules for that bill. Can you talk to that and talk about how this bill ties into that? Would this bill make it so that's not necessary, or does it not have anything to do with that?
Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman. Not sure if I can answer the question with just what you've given me, but I can try. So it would probably depend on the topic of the bill. DAS has rulemaking authority in a number of situations that clearly govern other agencies, and then in some cases where it doesn't. So, for instance, we adopt the Oregon Accounting Manual by administrative rule, and executive branch agencies under DAS's authority are required to follow that accounting manual in their accounting practices, and that's based on generally accepted government accounting practices. So in that case, an emergency clause on your bill, if it were to govern that, for instance, we would then immediately be able to update the accounting manual if necessary. If it wasn't something where we had that clear authority in statute, this bill could cover whatever changes might need to be made by the bill you're talking about.
So, can I follow up? So then you don't need that emergency clause to create the rules. Then is that what you're saying? Or
Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, in some cases DAS has clear statutory authority already to adopt rules that govern more agencies, but they are specific to areas like the accounting manual. So if it were an accounting issue, we already have that authority now. This bill wouldn't impact that. Mm-hmm. If it were something where we don't have that clear statutory authority, then this bill would cover our ability to make a rule for multiple agencies in that circumstance, and the emergency clause would allow it to happen as soon as the bill became law.
Can I follow again? So I'm kind of not understanding. I'm trying to figure out the rulemaking process for DAS, and so it might be helpful if you did that. So if you explained that a little bit. So in the case where a bill doesn't go into effect, if the law is passed, why does DAS need the bill to go into effect to make the rules on it? Why isn't the existence of an act sufficient to make rules?
Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman. In many cases, and this goes back to sort of the statutory construction and the way bills are written, operative dates and effective dates of the bill are what is often key in when agencies can begin to take action. So in many cases, the bill doesn't actually go into effect until January of next year, but an agency is given specific authority to take whatever actions need to be taken necessary in order for that to go into effect the following year, right? Because when the law goes into effect, you can't just flip a switch and adopt the rules. There's a long process of public notice and a hearing and changes and advisory committees and all those sorts of things. Does that help?
Yeah, that's helpful.
A little?
Yeah,
that's fine.
Representative Stark?
Thank you, Chair Fagan. Just a clarification, if you will. The example you gave just a moment ago, you said it was necessary primarily for a temporary basis, for 6 months to set these up while the agencies then kind of got things sorted out and the procedures. So that carrying over this, is this intended for temporary? Because if it is, I don't see that written in there.
Yeah. Chair Fagan, Representative Stark, that's a good question. No, it's not written to limit it only to temporary rules. In the example I gave, yes, it was a temporary rule because we were doing it in order to give, as I said, agencies time to figure it out. I think the way the bill is drafted now, we could adopt a uniform policy or a rule that would be a permanent rule, but it would have to go through the normal rulemaking process.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I don't have anybody else signed up, so would anybody else like to be heard on House Bill 2476? Okay, well, with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2476 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2637. And is Representative Lively here yet? Okay. Well, stand at ease for a moment.
Madam Chair,
yes.
While we're at ease, do you have matching bottles for every outfit?
And while Representative Lively is coming up, Wendy will read a summary of the bill.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2637 makes material representations in commercial communications about mortgage credit products and an unlawful trade practice. The bill requires records demonstrating compliance to be retained for 24 months.
Thank you. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Certainly. My name is John Lively. I'm state representative from House District 12, which is the city of Springfield. I'm pleased to be here. Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak in support of this measure and this early in the session. I wasn't planning to be ready for anything this early, but this turns out we're moving, so thank you for that. I want to first recognize how far we have come since the recession of 2008 and the many homeowners who lost their homes because of default on their mortgages as a result. We've all seen the information regarding what happened in the mortgage industry leading up to that time and can agree much has changed since that time to help address some of the shortcomings that led to so many of these defaults. Today, certainly the major mortgage providers are focused on not just following the rules, they are also working much closer with borrowers to minimize the amount of defaults in the future, and I applaud them for doing those things. We've come a long ways. But not everyone is committed or focused to provide the level of transparency and support. I'm not here to relive all that the history or to assign blame, but I'm here to offer some next steps for Oregonians. House Bill 2637 does not propose new regulations, but rather writes into Oregon statute what is already federal law. So this isn't new. This is the current federal law, and I'm just recommending we write into the statute. Some will argue that since it's already federal regulation, why bother putting it in the state code? For me, the answer is pretty simple: access and responsiveness. Currently, if an Oregon citizen has a potential complaint covered by the law, the only recourse they have is to follow the federal rule and complaint process. That means filing a complaint at the federal level. The chance of getting some response or the issue addressed at the federal level is slim to none. That is not to suggest they don't want to enforce the law. However, the sheer number of complaints and or how many similar complaints it would take before reaching that kind of the critical mass required to investigate and respond does not seem to leave the average Oregonian in a reasonable position of resolution. This measure simply gives Oregonian citizens the ability to seek an addressing of their complaints at the state level in the state of Oregon. While we are currently in a pretty unique environment regarding mortgage interest rates and the number of Oregonians at risk on default of their loans, this will not always be the case. In fact, even with the current environment, their loan providers continue to use deceptive advertising tactics to switch consumers to lower interest rates, better terms, and the list goes on of what they believe they can offer. As interest rates rise and the financial requirements to obtain and pay for loans increase, deceptive advertising is likely to increase as citizens search for more creative ways to acquire a loan or reduce payments on existing loans. No, I'm not recommending Oregon put in place additional rules to address the problems with deceptive advertising in the mortgage finance area. Just adopt what is already in place, providing an easier channel for Oregonians to have their complaints addressed. I encourage your support of this bill, and we'll try and answer any questions you have. I might just relate, I for some time have been working with my father, who elderly and managing his home and his properties. In doing that, I've come across several other elderly that I've worked with in where he now lives. And one of the things that continues to cause me concern is how they deal with understanding the rules when it comes to mortgages and what happens, and share with me some of the mail they receive encouraging them to take certain actions on their mortgage, which isn't action on their mortgage, even though the envelope indicates it's very important that you respond now, this is your mortgage. And I guess that's one of the things that's motivated me to keep to try to provide an opportunity for Oregonians to address those kind of things, because it's not just the elderly, it's certainly young people, but those especially are vulnerable to tactics that might lead them to believe it really is an issue with their mortgage when they don't have an issue with their mortgage. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Lively. Questions? Representative Holvey.
No, I'm not taking any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I've received some information about my mortgage all the time. And so are you talking about information that comes from institutions that aren't really holding your mortgage?
Right.
but they portray it as important mortgage documents, for example, on the front of the envelope, and you know, act now, your mortgage relies on prompt action, that sort of stuff, and it's coming from somebody that really doesn't have anything to do with your mortgage.
Representative Hovey and Chair, it's, from my standpoint, I've not seen in recent times any information coming from, where people have brought information to me from people that hold their mortgage, those that they're dealing with, that I would, or that concerns them from a standpoint of not knowing what it is. It's usually pretty clear who it's coming from. It's their mortgage holder. So you're exactly right. What I'm talking about is there's a lot of other people out there trying to get your business to switch to offer those terms and that, and it's those that represent, in many cases, that you have to read quite a ways into the letter to understand it's not your mortgage holder, it's somebody else that's trying to offer you a different deal. It doesn't mean the deal may not be all right, even, but depending on where you're at in your mortgage standing at the time and your ability to understand and respond to that, it may raise a concern about your mortgage that would cause you to go down a road that isn't in your best interest. That's correct.
Representative Stark.
Yes, thank you, Chair Fagan, and thank you for testifying on this today.
Certainly, thank you.
You mentioned the reporting, it makes it somewhat easier for people to report. Mm-hmm. And so will that increase or change that reporting process? Mm-hmm. And by changing it, therefore, would it have a side effect of, you know, increasing the number of hours people are manning that report desk, or some sort of a side effect where it would, because of the increased caseload, have a fiscal impact?
That's a very good question, Chair and Representative Stark. At this point, I think it would have very minimal impact. And so we already have people at the state, whether they be in the Department of Justice or the Department of Consumer and Business Services, that respond to consumer complaints about a wide variety of issues. And so those are the same people that would respond or be the persons to respond to these. And so there's nothing that I have seen in working with DCBS to see that there's any unexpected that there would be a large increase in responding to those complaints. Again, my concern is not so much for today, but it's as we move forward and interest rates go back up and things start to shift in the market, then there could be. You know, my anticipation is, like so many other programs that are available for people to file a complaint about business practices, the complaint level hopefully will be relatively low, but at least it gives them an ability in the state of Oregon to have somebody listen to the complaint and try to respond to it versus having to, quote, call the federal government to deal with the federal bureaucracy, which his chances are very little. So I have not heard or talked to anybody in the departments where this was having a substantial increase, and so I don't believe that's to be the case.
So if I have a complaint right now, it would go through the feds.
That's right.
Whereas if we do this and we have a complaint, it would now go through the state.
For those items, that's right, for those items to address. So one of the things about this measure, it's very specific. It's very, I mean, it goes through all the things in which would fall under this, so it's very prescriptive, I should say, about what those are, but that's correct. If you were to try to get redress under what the federal law and that says now, which we don't have in the code, your only choice would be to go through the federal process.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you. Just one more. So, Representative Lively, when having this drafted, did they discuss with you whether or not the state had authority over some of these institutions that are, you know, under federal charter, under federal law? I'm just sort of curious, does this apply to federally chartered institutions?
Chair, Representative Holby, I don't know the answer to that. We didn't have that conversation, so that's a great question, something we can certainly address, but that's not one that we had a conversation about.
We'll find out.
Just in terms of the way that I read it, I don't see there's any reason why it wouldn't. It's just any, you know, commercial claim about a commercial mortgage, and it's under the Unfair Trade Practices Act, but it looks like, as written, it can only be enforced by the Attorney General, not a private right of action.
That's right. Yeah. That's the way this is written.
And just to address, Representative Stark, your question, and we don't have anybody from the AG's office. I don't see Aaron here. But I think the way that typically works is when they pursue a claim under the Unfair Trade Practices Act, they have an opportunity, if they're successful, to actually obtain attorney's fees that actually covers their legal costs for pursuing the act. So if a bank, or not even a bank, but if a, you know, company making these deceptive claims was to be pursued by the Attorney General and have found to have violated the act, they can actually recoup the costs in attorney's fees, and actually, so that there isn't a taxpayer burden, it's actually paid for by the wrongdoer.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative.
I was just curious, you know, in certain cases, like, you know, fair housing cases, there's a choice where the state might pursue it, the federal government might pursue it, or, in fact, a civil attorney can pursue it when the state or the federal folks won't. Is there a reason why you chose not to allow a civil right of action under the UTPA?
Chair, Representative Rayfield, not, there's nothing that we had in our conversation, that one way or the other, I guess, from that standpoint, that there was no motivation to not have done that. So, no, not from my perspective.
Would you be opposed to allowing that?
No, I'm certainly open to having the conversation. Again, this was an issue we addressed last session, and I was trying to find a way to make it more palatable and not to write a whole bunch of other, I guess, complications and rules into it. And that's when I saw the federal legislation. It seemed like the easiest way is to take what was already law. But I'm open to this point if there's ways to make it more amenable, make it more flexible, or whatever the case may be, and still address, you know, deceptive advertising. I'm open to having those conversations. Sure.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Hang around in case you want to maybe, I'm assuming there'll be at least one person opposing this. Do you want to hang around in case you want to come back up and discuss, or if
I
not?
But, no, I'll hang around.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much.
So I will call up Pam Leavitt from the credit unions. Okay. Well, you have it listed as neutral. I'm assuming that the bankers are opposed, so.
No, we're both neutral.
You're both neutral, okay.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I mark that on here just for?
I marked, no, neutral.
it was supposed to be marked neutral.
Okay, great. So, okay, can I do
Yeah,
you wouldn't. Might get the clerk down here. Okay, we didn't do anything. Don't come down here. No, that's fine. I just didn't want the clerk to come down here. I didn't mark it because I didn't want the clerk to come down here. Okay, great. State your name.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pam Leavitt, representing the Northwest Credit Union Association. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I also want to thank Representative Lively for bringing this very important issue. Credit unions in Oregon have worked very hard to work with our members over the years. When they've gotten in trouble or have come to us with some mortgage problems. And so we certainly support the goals of the bill to be as open and fair in advertising. I will tell you, when I shared this bill with our members, our credit unions, and our compliance staff, they just had some questions. And we are currently neutral on the bill. We'd certainly like to continue our conversations with Representative Lively. But a couple things I want to point out, and I usually provide written testimony, and I didn't plan on testifying until about an hour ago, but I will provide this background to you tonight. ORS 646-608 already makes it a violation to make false or misleading representations concerning credit availability. The same regulation is a violation to engage in other unfair or deceptive acts. The Attorney General has issued a regulation under these provisions that make it a UTPA violation in Truth in Lending. So basically what I'm trying to tell you is we have some state regulations already in Truth in Lending and advertising. At the federal level, Reg Z is commonly known as the federal regulation that requires lenders to only advertise the terms they're offered. There are some restrictions. These include the requirements for advertising in terms of interest rates, APR, payment requirements, and other issues. So we have both state law and federal law currently on advertising mortgage loans. And so I did talk to Representative Lively's office a little bit earlier today, trying to understand what is the purpose of the bill? What are we trying to fix that's not already in the list of myriad federal and state regulations? And they did tell me they wanted to put the federal regulations in state statute for a stronger enforcement. I'd like to just talk to my credit unions, find out what is the regulatory burden of doing that? What does that mean on a day-to-day cost basis, especially for our small credit unions, when you take that federal regulation and put it in state statute? Also, I got some comments back that there is some requirements under the Unfair, Deceptive, or Abusive Acts or Practices Act. If we don't qualify under Reg Z or National Credit Union Administrative Rules, we can still be hit with some laws related to deceptive and misleading advertising. So certainly want to make sure that consumers are well served by strong information, good information relating to their mortgage loan. I just want to make sure from a credit union member perspective that we're not adding additional burden upon already things that are already in place in federal and state statute. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. I will provide this some of this background to you today.
Mr. Cosgrove.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Independent Community Banks of Oregon, Oregon Bankers Association, and Oregon Financial Services Association. Between Pam's client and the ones I'm representing today, we represent all of the regulated and licensed mortgage lenders in the state of Oregon. The problem addressed by Representative Lively is a real one. And it, in fact, it's one that has concerned bankers for a number of years, where deceptive people saying, I'm your bank, put the name in, Wells Fargo, it doesn't matter, whichever bank or credit union, I can fix your problem, please call me. It's similar to what I got last night, which was a phone call on my home line from somebody, I just listened to the voicemail, I didn't pick it up, from the San Fernando Valley saying that it was important that I respond because the judge was going to get me in contempt if I didn't show up tomorrow. There are scams around, and these are scams, and they are confusing to elderly people, and it's a real problem. The Oregon Bankers has, in fact, supported bills in past sessions to address that problem. It's not the same version as Representative Lively is used here, and we have not had a chance yet to talk to him. Things are moving fast in this session, but we will do so. And I think there's a formulation we can come to that addresses this real problem without raising the concerns that we have about the current version. And those concerns are, as the chair well knows, Unlawful Trade Practices Act deals with things that are done negligently, and we don't want to have this cover the situation, which is not what Representative Lively has mentioned as being the problem, and we don't think it is either, where if you have done a mailing and there's some problem in the print job where your 2.2 came out 2.3% and you find that, but you should have found it earlier, your editing was not good, that is technically could be a UTPA violation. We don't want the bill to cover those kinds of things. We'd like it to cover the true fraudulent activity that he's testified about and that we agree is a problem. So I think we can find a solution. It may not be quite this formulation, but we can find one that everybody can be happy with. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, great. I'm going to ask a question real quick, so if we have any other ones. But to Pam, you were mentioning, so can you help me understand? You said there's already What's already in Oregon law? I mean, and this might be too. You may have not have had time to look at this, which is fine. We're not working it today.
Okay.
Pam forwarded her some of this information. Mm-hmm. Under the current UTPA right now, it is an unlawful trade practice for any kind of a business, mortgage lending or other, to appropriate somebody else's name and identify that they are the provider of this goods or services or real estate using somebody else's name. It's already one of the many enumerated UTPA things. So that's already there for the true misappropriation of somebody's name, trying to mislead the consumer that I'm really Wells Fargo when you're not. You're Joe Smith down the corner store or out of state or in the Bahamas or wherever these things are coming from. So that's, I think, at least one of the state statutes.
Specifically that single, you know, if they were misappropriating a name, that's covered under the UTPA.
Yes.
And just to be clear, not every company, right, because insurance companies are exempt under the UTPA, isn't that right? Just to be clear, because you said no matter what the company. So just to be clear.
Neither are pawnbrokers or attorneys.
Okay, there you go.
Yes.
So, Madam Chair, it's my understanding if you violate the Truth in Lending Act, the Attorney General has stated that is a UTPA violation.
That is also true.
So that is the state saying this is a UTPA violation if you violate Truth in Lending, which is a federal
But in any case, to the extent we need to, Madam Chair, if I may, call this out as a special statutory section that addresses the kind of problem that Representative Lively is addressing, that's certainly something we can do. We need to work on how we formulate it, and we're happy to do so with him.
Okay, great. Representative Holby.
Thanks. And I appreciate that. I remember that particular piece of legislation about using someone else's name. But if I'm not mistaken, this bill is also not just about that, using somebody else's name or pretending you're somebody else. It's the misleading aspect that they don't actually use somebody else's name, but they refer to your mortgage. They didn't use somebody else's name. They just said, this is from the Mortgage Processing Center.
Right.
These are important mortgage documents, and they're not using Wells Fargo or any of the other names. And so I'm not sure whether that probably does fall under the UTPA. I don't know for sure or not, but I think, you know, that's an example of some of the other things that happen out there, because I've gotten them. I've turned them over to DCBS and the Attorney General's office, and there's really not much they can do about it. And so,
comment, Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, that is the evolution of scams going on in, yes, in this state and the country. You are seeing the scammers evolve into how to figure out how to work their way through some of these laws.
Right, and I think follow up. Thank you. And I think that's, you know, I think where Representative Lively is trying to go is that some of these scams are just skirting around the direct language, right, that we have in addressing these things. And so that, I mean, that's one of the things I'm hearing from Representative Lively on this issue. So I don't know specifically whether our UTPA and banking laws already handle that in the state of Oregon very well. I'm not sure we quite have it nailed down yet.
And Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, we would like to help craft something that attacks any of those areas of misrepresentation, whether they've used the name or not. The reason I use that example is that is a common way the scam is carried out. But I agree, it sometimes just says important documents. It sometimes in the phone call says the judge is going to hold me in contempt of court if I don't do something. People do all sorts of crazy things. But the intentional misrepresentation issue, we're quite in agreement, needs to be addressed, and we'll make sure we try to do that in a way that doesn't get unintentional consequences, but that gets all of the sick cameras.
What's interesting to me is that a lot of these, you know, problems, I've actually gotten some of these in the mail, so I'm very familiar with it. And so if there are federal regulations that do apply, I mean, my first question is, why am I still getting these things? And why is it going to change if we put it into state law? And so my second question is, would it make sense, or would you support a private right of action to kind of for other consumers to pursue when the state or the federal government clearly aren't solving the problem?
Yeah, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Rayfield, the Uniform Trade Practices Act, when it is dealing with intentional misrepresentation, already has a private right of action. If we added another clause for intentional misrepresentation, however we define it, to cover all the kinds of scams we can think of, and put it under UTPA for a private right of action, that's where it is now. And that would not be any significant change. The problem we have is catching people who unintentionally make a mistake in an ad by one digit kind of thing, who then correct it. We would rather not have lawsuits either from the Attorney General or a private attorney on those issues. So that's the line we're trying to find.
So it is the answer to the question that you, if it was outside of the UTPA, because my impression was that you were talking about crafting something outside of the UPA to address the issue. So if it was outside the UPTA, that's where my question is aimed at.
And I'm not quite sure I know how to respond to that yet. But I think what we'll do is sit down, of course, with Representative Lively and some of the attorneys who represent our various institutions and see what we can come up with. And it may very well be, though, putting it under UTPA directly is the right way to do it. This bill does that, in fact. The concern is it covers some unintentional stuff as well as the intentional stuff.
Madam Chair, Representative Rayfield, I just wanted to make a statement that, you know, the state and federal regulations are for, you know, regulated entities, and some of these folks we're talking about probably aren't following state and federal law, and it might be an enforcement issue out of the Attorney General's office or a regulator's office also that we need to look into.
Thank you.
Representative Stark. So,
thank you, Chair Fagan. This may be a question for Rep. Lively, but we'll try with you guys. So if this is basically mimicking the federal law at the state level, then is it that the feds are doing a bad job of enforcing this, and therefore we need the state to do something on it?
Madam Chair, Representative Stark, I'm not sure I can answer that completely. Let me give you at least my thought. Federal consumer protection agencies tend to use their resources for big picture issues involving thousands of people and tend not to be, I don't mean to be disrespectful to them, tend not to be terribly responsive to an individual consumer's complaint. And typically we have, when we've had state laws in this and lots of other areas, we've done them because we think they would be more user-friendly to the individual consumer than leaving them to just deal with a faceless big federal agency in D.C. I mean, that's an oversimplification by far, but at least some of that, I think, is based on history of people having complaints not go anywhere when they made them to the feds.
Thank you. Any other questions? Great. Well, thank you both for entertaining a lot of questions. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Do you want to, or you want to go? You don't want to go back up? Okay. Well, we have one other. We have a member of the public who would like to testify on this bill. So, Rebecca Roth. Please state your name for the record and
Rebecca
proceed.
Rebecca Roth. And I didn't know anything about this bill before, but just in hearing about, can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay. So just in hearing about it, I was reminded when in about 1992 or so at the federal level, Clinton and the Democrats took away the Glass-Steagall Act, and they passed the Community Reinvestment Act. And then the very young lawyer, Barack Obama, and his organization, ACORN, pressed lawsuits against banks and harassed them and forced them into giving loans that they knew couldn't be repaid. So that kind of went along, and the Democrat Party blocked efforts that were made to investigate Fannie Mae. And I just heard a man who was, I don't have his name with me because I didn't think I was going to come here, so if you want me to go find his name, I will. But I just heard him, he is high up in Fannie Mae, or was, anyway, he's now speaking out, and he says that the exact same thing is going to happen again because nothing has been fixed. The problem with taking away the Glass-Steagall Act is that when local banks give loans, then they also can play in the stock market. And so he said that the exact same thing is being pushed by the federal government. And my concern is that all of this dysfunction that's been in the federal government, I don't know if it will be brought here through this. I just heard, is he representative? Okay, I just heard him say that that this was going to bring it here and make it here. So I don't want to expand whatever dysfunction is at there, at that level. And the questions that were raised here about can't this be handled through the things that already are in place? And I just don't want to expand the dysfunction that's there. And The other part I'm concerned about is that here in Oregon, we'll bring to Oregon this same kind of thing that was done by Barack Obama and his ACORN group to harass the banks here. And I don't know if that can be done, but it seems like anything lawyers want to do, they get around, they go into the government and they do it to us. So it's not just... it's not just those letters that come in the mail. It's the people that get into politics that are actually criminals.
Thank you very much, Ms. Roth. Thanks for having the courage to testify. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 2637? Okay. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2637 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2578. And while Representative Barnhart is coming forward, I will have Wendy read a summary of the bill.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2578 requires telecommunications utility contracts exceeding 3 months to include a provision allowing the customers to terminate their contract without penalty if that customer enters a hospice program.
Oh, yes, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. House Bill 2578 came up as a result of a constituent concern about precisely the issue that it describes. As I'm sure the members of the committee are aware, it is not unusual for various telecommunications contracts with consumers to have extended periods of applicability with a penalty for early termination. And so the point of the bill was to deal with that issue. The intent of raising it in connection with the hospice care issue is, of course, we're talking primarily about people who have entered a particular form of care for those who are in imminent likelihood of death, and as a result of some kind of a health problem, requiring them to continue to pay on expensive telecommunications contracts that they no longer have a need for or a use for seems unusually cruel in the face of what they're already facing in other areas. And that's how the issue came up. I will say to the committee that the bill is not ready for prime time today because it needs some fixes. One of the key issues is that simply reading the bill, you might think that telecommunications utilities applies to all of these things I've said. In fact, it does not, and it requires some amendments so that we make certain we're covering cell phone services and perhaps cable services and some other kinds of services where that kind of penalty might apply to an early termination. It also is missing any kind of an enforcement. And it seems to me that the reasonable approach to this for enforcement would be to use the Unlawful Trade Practices Act approach so that the Attorney General can enforce it. Of course, a bill like this cannot apply to an existing contract because we can't impair contracts under the federal constitution. So it would only apply prospectively into the future of new contracts that might be signed later. So I commend the bill to your use, but I will tell you that I'm preparing amendments so you could actually use it if you decided to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't ask any questions at the last meeting, so I thought I'd get a couple in.
You're in the dead of one.
Representative Barnhart, I was hearing some similar issues around contracts, especially with cell phones and things like that. And one of the things I heard that was kind of disturbing that I haven't quite fully investigated was that you can't even terminate a contract with some of these services even after death. So your bill may need to, consider not just hospice.
Thank you for that.
Thank
Representative
you.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, I think that's a very good criticism of my proposed amendment, and I'll add that. Thank you.
Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, following the line of thought here, I'm really curious. I mean, it is, I think, very important that we do think about hospice patients and certainly try to consider their situations. Are there similar kinds of laws at all that apply to hospice or people who are sort of terminally ill? Is there anything similar to what you're asking here?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, I have to tell you, I do not know.
Yeah.
We chose this particular marker because it is fairly narrow. It only applies to a few people, and it gives the state of Oregon a chance to try out an idea without making it large and and difficult financially for the telecommunications companies.
Interesting.
It may very well be that it ought to be broader.
Well, I think it's a great test case, maybe. I'm just thinking with the baby boom generation, we're going to have more and more of these hospice situations. So this, be interesting.
I think along with Representative Gallegos' comment, I was thinking just in general about going into hospice care, because obviously it's not just cell phone contracts. I recall last session in the Veterans Committee, I think we dealt with gym memberships, and when you get deployed or something, or you actually have to move for a military assignment, and but your 24-hour fitness, you have that early termination fee. So it'll be interesting. I mean, I certainly appreciate it as a test case, looking forward, looking at maybe moving it narrowly, or also just looking at other types of contracts that have those early termination fees that would also need to be maybe, those effects be mitigated for Oregonians going into hospice care.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's a reasonable thing, and I look at the relating clause of this bill. This bill doesn't get you there.
Okay. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. And maybe my attorney colleagues can answer this better than I can, but rather than writing it in a manner in which says all contracts can't be over 3 months and so forth, if the point is so that in these unforeseen circumstances where someone goes into hospice, instead of having them rewrite all of their contracts, these cell phone companies and so forth, is it possible to just write some sort of a statute that says if you go into, you have permission to break contracts in these scenarios?
Madam Chair, Representative Stark, I think that's a reasonable way to to reword the bill. What the bill doesn't actually say you can't have a contract for more than 3 months. What it is intended to say is that if the contract is for longer than 3 months, then it has to include this termination provision.
Right. And the follow up to explain my question is, so as I read that, all these companies would have to change their contract paperwork in order to have it say that they have this clause so that they could get out of it if it had hospice, if they went into hospice. So it seems like everyone would have to change their paperwork to meet this, as opposed to writing something that would just allow them out of an existing contract. Is that, am I not making sense here?
Well, Madam Chair, I think I may be able to answer that if I can try. Representative Stark, the state doesn't have the authority, the power, as I understand it, to tell a company and a customer that they can't write a contract, nor can we influence what the contract says that's already in existence at the time the statute becomes effective, as I understand it. What we can do is to say, if you write a contract with these kinds of provisions, then you have to include this other provision that we've told you to include in future contracts. That's the way that you deal with the impairment of contracts issue that comes from the 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. I agree. The implication of your question is that it's kind of clumsy. I agree. It is kind of clumsy, but that's the way we can do it.
Thank you.
And to address your question as one of your attorney colleagues, and I will only bill you 0.1 for this, Representative Barnhart's correct that we can't pass a law to impair the obligation of existing contracts, but having a statute that says, a utility may not enter into a contract, whether it's in their paperwork or not, contracts that would be after the effective date of this act, if they had a provision saying, no matter what, come hell or high water, you pay our early termination fee, that would just be an unenforceable provision of that contract if that contract was entered into after the date of this. So they actually wouldn't have to change their paperwork. They just, that part of the, there's usually a severability clause in most contracts that says if any part of this contract is unenforceable, the rest of it still is. And that would probably just be a portion that would be unenforceable just under the law.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you, Madam Chair. That does illustrate the value of having attorneys who have been in practice recently. The last time I actually practiced law was in 1978.
I wasn't born, but thank you, Representative Stark. Thank you very much for
that,
Representative. And so all I have signed up to testify is Brant Wolf, but if anyone else would like to testify, please come up as well.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brant Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association, and for the purposes of this particular hearing, our members are those telecommunications utilities indicated by this bill. We're neutral on this bill. We would clearly abide by whatever rules were passed as related to it. Our only concern was exactly as laid out by Representative Barnhart, that it didn't apply to everybody, it just applied to us. And that's really, I don't have anything to add to that, actually. I'll work with Representative Barnhart on any amendments he cares to draft, and I don't need to take any of your time, actually. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any of me.
So just to be clear, so when you say not, so it wouldn't apply to, so if I had a phone with you, it applies. If I have a cell phone with AT&T, it wouldn't apply. That's what you mean by not everybody else.
Okay. That's correct. Yeah, the definition is pretty clear about what utility is and is not. And wireless carriers, carriers, VoIP carriers such as Comcast, Charter, et cetera, they are not utilities.
Thank you. No questions? Great. Thank you, Brant.
Thank you.
All right, final call. Anyone else would like to be heard on House Bill 2578? Okay. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2578. And that's all we've got on our agenda today. Is there anything else for the good of the order? Okay. Now we'll close the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. And Government Effectiveness.